Hello, welcome back to Medical Mum's Chat. We're bringing you a new series today. This is episode one of Ask a Medical Mum. We're joined by the lovely Dr. Talat Upal, an obs and gynae from the Northern Beaches in Sydney, who has worked through a case with me, Beck Lettingham, a rural generalist and amateur podcaster in the northwest of Australia, of a lady with heavy menstrual bleeding in perimenopause, which was timely as we had this chat on World Menopause Day, 18th of October. Check out the show notes for all the resources and for the key point take-home points. And if you like this episode and you'd love to see more episodes of Ask a Medical Mum, maybe you are one with an update to give, get in touch, or maybe you've got a question that you would love to ask the Brains Trust and find the answer to, let us know what topics you want covered. I hope you enjoy listening to this chat. I've very much enjoyed meeting Talat, and I thank her for kicking us off with this. Enjoy. A quick note before we start to tell you that there is a bit of audio interference in a couple of minutes in, but don't worry, it doesn't last too long. Persevere, it's only about 15, 20 seconds. Cheers.
Hello, Beck. My name is Dr. Talat Upal, and I'm one of the obstetricians and gynecologists in Sydney. I'm really excited about our chat today, and I'm hoping that we can discuss about heavy menstrual bleeding, particularly in a perimenopausal woman, which is so relevant because today, 18th of October, is World Menopause Day.
Wonderful. So just a little bit about you before we kick off with the clinical update chat. Mm-hmm. Why did you become an obstetrician gynecologist?
Good question, Beck. I knew I wanted to do women's health ever since I was a medical student, and I grew up in Africa. And I remember when I did my ONG term and I was in our tertiary hospital then, the connection, and I've never looked back and thought that that was the wrong decision for me, even though at times, obviously, it has been challenging, particularly having had three babies in training. So with the sort of hours we used to have, particularly I think the last 10 years, it has been good to see some traction in the safe hours side of things. But I've never looked back. I feel connected in this particular space. And I think that there's so much to do and there's so much disadvantage that women face overall, particularly in the health side of things. And I feel that motivation is something that drives me to do more and more for the women that we care for.
Excellent. And what would you say is one of the biggest highlights of being an obstetrician and gynecologist?
I think that magic in birth, Beck. Like, no matter how many times you do deliveries, I think it's something that doesn't fade. And that absolute, you know, the first time the baby cries, and obviously a lot of our job also dealing with loss and with difficult situations. But however, I think, you know, that magic of a family is just such a privilege for us to share that journey of women and their families.
Yeah, excellent. Mm-hmm. I agree.
It's a cliche answer, but honestly, it is just magic.
Yeah. Now, we are getting a little bit of technological interference here. I'm getting a bit of bouncing of audio, so apologies for that. But that's because you're coming to us from the labour ward. Is that right?
Yes. So do you? Yes. Well, I'm actually in the office, but yes. Yeah. If you're hearing any shouting in the background, no, I'm only joking.
It's just the audio just did a bit of. I think it's okay, but it just did a bit of. You know. What would, if there's someone listening who wants to go down the path of ONG training, do you have a couple of tips for them?
Yes, I think that it is very fulfilling, Beck, and it is, however, still a bit of a juggle, and there's no way to sugarcoat that, particularly if, you know, having babies is on the horizon for that particular person. But I think that things have moved forward so much compared to previously, that there's so much more support for part-time roles, for, you know, support for pregnancy and for maternity leave, and there's so much diversity now in terms of whether people want to do only gynecology or they want to be a generalist obstetrician and gynecologist or subspecialized. I think the future is very bright, and I would be very encouraging of those that come behind us, and to reach out for the support that is there for them. Sometimes women don't always articulate or ask for help or seek better solutions that are more aligned with their personal lives and their social lives and their, you know, other work is still just a piece of the pie as far as I'm concerned. And it's important to recognize that early and find strategies to make it work well for you.
Excellent. Now we're going to bring in, this is our first ever clinical update. I don't know if we'll come up with a catchy name, but maybe Ask a Medical Mum. So I'm going to bring you a case. All the cases that we talk about today and going forward will be not real, but just a kind of conglomerate of the cases that we see in real life. And usually I think in this kind of space, a common occurring case, and this definitely is. So I'm a GP, as you know, and so I'll be the GP and you can be my specialist colleague.
Specialist Beck, your specialist life.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. So I see this lady, not infrequently, a version of her.
Yes.
So today let's talk about Nerida. She's 46 and she's coming to me. She's just very tired, much more tired than usual. So she's got an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. And she's just put her mum in a nursing home, so she's pretty stressed about that. And when I see these women, I ask about their sleep because sleep and tiredness are so inextricably linked.
Absolutely.
Her sleep's okay. Nothing really changed there. She's getting enough sleep. And then I ask about their menstrual cycle. Pretty much that's the second cab off the rank for somebody like this.
Excellent.
So she tells me that she's never had a problem before, but her periods are getting heavier and they're getting a little bit less easy to predict. So they're starting to be not 26 days as they always were, but sometimes she'll go 5 weeks, sometimes she'll go 3 weeks, and they're beginning to get very heavy. Mm-hmm. So I'll do a few investigations and including hemoglobin and iron, and probably get her started on iron because this sounds like we're on the money of what's one of the problems that she's facing. Yeah. When I discuss her options about this, how would you suggest we kind of give her options? She actually says to me, "I'm the oldest woman in my family to still have a uterus, so it might be time for me to get that out."
Hint, hint, hint.
Yeah.
Okay, Beck. So this is an excellent, very typical scenario. I agree with you. We see these women every day, multiple times, and I think that the tiredness and the what we call the perimenopausal joys go hand in hand, don't they? Because you're very right, it could be sleep. It could certainly be the fact that she's having periods that are more frequent, that are lasting longer, that are probably heavier than what she's used to. Or it could be obviously something else pathological, like a thyroid issue. And once we go through that entire list that she's not having, you know, any substance dependence or anything else that may be contributing to this picture, the most typical scenario is that her periods have gotten, you know, irregular and they're contributing to this situation. So I try to make, first of all, try and figure out that, is there a medical issue as far as the heavy periods are concerned. So one of the best baseline starting point investigations is an pelvic ultrasound, that's transvaginal. And basically there is a recent Australian Commission document, which is called a clinical care standard on heavy menstrual bleeding. And the reason this was developed, Beck, was because there was a lot of variation across the country in how we were managing and treating women like this. But anyway, to come back to this particular patient, so the ultrasound ideally should be done between day 5 to 10, because that is when she's just completed her period and the lining is the thinnest. And so it is far easier to see any structural abnormalities, like, for example, a polyp or a fibroid, particularly if these are poking into the uterus or they're submucous, they are more likely to be contributing to this picture. However, it could be that she has, and one of the other very critical points in her journey is, does she have any pain or not, Beck? because then that could point towards, does she have any underlying endometriosis or adenomyosis? And these structural abnormalities of the uterus are important, not only because they sort of guide us as to what options are available for her, but also predict, you know, what, you know, whether we can just manage with conservative or whether we do need to lean into some more higher end surgical options. So when I see these women, I usually start back by just saying, hey, listen, this is a problem with many solutions. Generally speaking, we're spoiled for choice. And I'm so grateful that, you know, to you and your general practitioner specialist who has referred you, because now we can start finding which solution, you know, will be the best fit for you. And isn't Beck, I think two concepts are emerging more and more as we hopefully move towards a less patriarchal society, if I can put that tactfully. So one is about quality of life. So if the woman thinks it's a problem for us. So we're moving away from obsessing with how many red blood cells did you bleed and, you know, all those kind of discussions, and moving towards, is this affecting you? Whether this is affecting you socially, whether this is affecting your, you know, your quality of life in terms of your activities that you enjoy that you're no longer able to do, whether this is affecting your work or your ability to make, you know, your relationship with your children, every whatever level that you feel, or financially, or in any way this is affecting you, then it's a problem that needs to be supported. And so that's a quality of life.
It's interesting you should say that, because she's reached out to her family because she doesn't think she can keep going on like this. Mm-hmm. But her mum and her auntie both say, just we'll just get a hysterectomy, because that's what they did. Yeah. And so they don't know how long it's going to last.
Yes.
And she's got a bit of a fear of having an operation. So actually she's left it much longer than she would have, but she doesn't. She's fearful of operations.
Okay. And that's a very, very important to, I think that brings me to the second point where women need to be in the driving seats of their healthcare, but how do they do that until they're empowered with information? And so hearing this woman's journey, it is important. I can uncover that she's got some health anxiety and she has probably a fear of some of the options, but perhaps it's not really realize that there may be other options. I am actually impressed with her mum and auntie who have actually encouraged her to seek care. So not like many of my patients who say they speak to some elders or mothers-in-law who just normalizes and say, oh, it's going to end, honey. But I'm like, I'm doing the maths. I'm like, she's only 45 and the average age of menopause is 51. So that means that 6 years, even if she's Jane Smith on the national average, she's got 6 years of this ahead. So no, that's not a good idea. So great, good on her mum and auntie for at least getting behind her and saying, go get something done. Even if it's,
and if I could just, I'll just pick up on the ultrasound as well, because I think there's things in our profession that we normalize that are completely unnormal, not normal for the general population. So how do you prepare somebody for a transvaginal scan?
Okay, so I do say that, look, this is going to be like a, I call it a magic wand. I don't know, for want of a better way of describing this. It is a wand that and it is a probe. And I do say, because I see a lot of women back that have a high, you know, may have a mental health background or may have, and it's my privilege to be able to care for these women, or previous history of sexual assault, or, you know, they're just a more vulnerable group. And I want them not to fear that ultrasound, but yet go for it at the right time and reach out for that investigation, because it does make our life much easier to triage for them. So I do say that, look, if you're at all uncomfortable about having a vaginal ultrasound, you could choose to put the probe in yourself, or you could say, look, I don't want a transvaginal one, give me a transabdominal one. At the end of the day, we have to do whatever she's comfortable with. Was that what you meant, Beck? Or
yeah, and I also think from our sonography colleagues that just giving them the heads up is usually goes a long way, rather than the first time they realize is when
it's actually going in. Yes.
Yeah, it picks up the probe and puts the condom on, which I think is also the imagery is quite daunting if you don't know. So I usually say, if it's okay with you, this ultrasound will be an internal ultrasound. Yeah. And just so you know, the probe is a long, I also call it a wand. Yeah. And I do mention the condom, because I just think that that's quite confronting a scene, to see somebody uh-huh. taking out a condom, you know, if you haven't known that was, to us it's so common.
Yes.
It's an interesting thing to be confronted with, I think.
I'm so glad you've articulated that, Beck. That's excellent counseling and would no doubt prepare her far better than if she just was like, what is this? Is this going inside me? It can be quite confronting. And I think also the way that services are set up also, it is important to have that privacy and that ability to, you know, some of the, like, previously, for example, you know, at times women were asked to make fists and raise their pelvis, and that's a very disempowering women position for women in general, and not necessarily in the transvaginal context. I think we always have to think, look, what's the most dignified way that we can examine or investigate this woman as a health service or as a care provider or even as a clinician in our rooms?
I agree. Thin prep is good. They give out little pillows.
Exactly.
Every time I move practices, I call them.
I love that too. Okay, So
we get the ultrasound back. She's got iron deficiency anemia, so we deal with that. I like iron infusions, and so I'll arrange one of those. And the ultrasound shows a reasonably normal anatomy.
Okay.
She's definitely not that happy with these periods. They're not painful, but she doesn't like losing this much blood, and it's causing her to not go out and not get involved in life. And particularly when they take her by surprise when she's at work, she's not enjoying that. So what are her options now?
Okay, excellent.
This heavy ritual?
So what I, at this point, I would like to go through from basic to more invasive options. So if, for example, just putting her on Ponstan or some non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, even if she doesn't have pain, can reduce some of her bleeding. However, in some ways, you know, it's a small benefit. And so definitely considering a Myrina device is what I feel is a very good first line management. Oral contraceptive pill, if she wasn't 45, would have been again another option. But, you know, we were obsessing with, we're obsessing with clots long before AstraZeneca took all the spotlight in that space. So I think that we have to be mindful that increased risk of venous thromboembolism with being above 40. So I would then encourage her to consider a levonorgestrel intrauterine system. And that can be inserted by many GP specialists. And again, it's important, Beck, to get the timing right, so that it's recommended that we consider that. We actually do that within day 1 to 7. And the reason is because A, obviously you want the woman not to be pregnant, but B, the cervix is ever so slightly open. So procedurally, if this is going to be done in the rooms, it is actually slightly easier to insert during, technically from a technical point of view. The third option for her, which I have a device that is, I bring out, and I say this from my toy box, and that is an ablation device. And I feel that the 3D actually showing it, even though it's quite long and scary, actually demystifies it for women. And I asked their permission. I said, look, can I show you this? And most women, I feel, really are intrigued by their bodies. And, you know, Beck, one reflection I have is that despite high education levels, despite high socioeconomic, you know, on various scenarios, I find that women, a lot of women, do not know much about their women bits. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I have a lot of samples and show people. I also have a box that the Myrina comes in, because, again, when the pharmacy hands over the Myrina box, I've had people bail on their Myrina insertions because they can't get their head around the size of the box.
I 100% agree with you. I do prepare them for that. I said the box is going to be massive, but I promise this is the device. It's only 3 centimeters. So, yeah, no, you're right. So
I've done a bit of probing, and she had a colleague who went to Thailand for some plastic surgery and died on the table, which is why she's scared of operations. So what's the – how does ablation work? Is it a general anesthetic?
Okay, so thank you for reminding us about the most important thing to ask her why she's anxious about the surgical procedure. So yes, it is a general anesthetic. And what it does is that it has I tend to have a preference for novitiate endometrial ablations because, Beck, they are triangular in the nature. And once we feed in the dimensions of the uterus when the woman is asleep, it actually almost perfectly, as near perfectly, in this, for example, this patient is a really good candidate for this because she doesn't have massive fibroids. She doesn't have, because it's a normal ultrasound, we obviously would sample the lining as well before we do the ablation, but we are unlikely to be looking at a uterine malignancy if the ultrasound is normal. So I would encourage her to consider that if she didn't want hormones, and if after unpacking why she doesn't want surgery, she was okay to consider a surgical option, then that could be a good surgical option for her because she's perimenopausal. However, Beck, the problem with ablation is that it's not contraceptive. Okay. And the fact that obviously she's having periods means those ovaries are working. So do need to think about contraception because a pregnancy after A, any unplanned pregnancy is very undesirable, but B, pregnancy after an ablation is particularly high risk. It is really not what we want. And so I say to them, look, the Australian Menopause Society recommends that, even when someone becomes menopausal under 50, we should actually cover them with contraception for 2 years. So you're actually still perimenopausal. So we need to actually think through what would you like for contraception. So some women then want their tubes done at the same time, Beck. Others are like, there is a combination of a Mirena and ablation that we could consider. Others are like, I try to gently encourage perhaps the husband or if the partner could consider one for the team at this point. So because a vasectomy is another really good option available to them. And so those are the kind of things. And so I meant to highlight earlier that it's really important. I know you mentioned two children, but it is very important for us to black and white ask, are you thinking of having any more children? Have you completed your family or is this? And I often ask them, is this a comma or a full stop? And then sometimes they say it's a full stop with 3! I'm like, okay.
So ablation is to be regarded as permanent then?
Yes, it is.
Rather than reversible.
Yes, it is a permanent option for them in terms of there's no turning back in terms of because we are actually denuding the lining of that uterus. Obviously, in a small number of cases, Becky can fail. And generally speaking, it fails more often if women are quite young when they have it. So obviously, because they have, the timeline ahead to regrow that endometrium. The other problem with ablation is that they can have troublesome discharge for a couple of months. And so I do prepare them for the worst case scenarios. There's a really good document back from RCOG, which says recovery after an ablation. And I find that although it's quite voluminous, it's really helpful. So I package, there's a heavy menstrual bleeding document from Ranscock. The standards that I mentioned earlier, they have a good more the clinician document plus a patient document. And there's also the RCOG one that I mentioned. So I try to
link all of these in the show notes.
Oh, excellent. As well. Excellent, yeah. Beck. I try to tailor it though. I think it can be very overwhelming if you get 10 different digital pamphlets. So I try to figure out, look, what does she want? But then sometimes if they haven't read the pamphlets, they're not making that decision. They're making that decision on a 20-minute consult. And so it's a bit of a chicken egg to figure out. That's why I like the Ranscock one, because it's quite overarching. And then I think, depending on what she's leaning towards, we then give her more detail on that. So for example, if someone was not suitable for an ablation, then I would give her exactly what she was more suitable for, because you don't want to overwhelm her with too much information. But what I have found, Beck, is that in this space, when we are giving them good quality information from authentic sources, I'm getting far less of Dr. Google said this and Dr. Google said that. So I think that we fondly call it our homework, but I think that it's very helpful to give them that. And I find that GP practitioners that give information prior to them coming to see me, it's even more helpful because then they have gotten their head around what are the options and the discussion is more mature. Whereas otherwise I feel I'm starting from a very basic level and then they are building up. Because as understandably, Beck, I get referrals from some excellent general practitioners who are, you know, very involved in women's health, but you are specialists in life and it's unreasonable to expect that everybody is going to be, you know, having women's health as their specific, you know, interest. And so obviously there are some women that come to me with very basic information. And I think that's one place where we could optimize care by front loading. And the problem at your end as a GP specialist is that you're often very poor for time. So I'm very realistic in my understanding of the workflow.
So I'm a proud Marina user, quite a and a Marina inserter.
Yes.
And we in where I live, we've got one of the first women's health nurses in Australia that was trained and certified to insert Marinas.
Fantastic.
Has put in most of the local doctors' Marinas over the last 10 years. And so we often tell our patients that it's the doctor's choice because that seems to help validate it as a choice.
Yes.
Because people have a funny, you know, they feel it's funny to put something inside you initially when you start talking about this option.
Yeah.
And I also talk about Cleopatra, who used to put a diamond, or, you know, was the first IUD was a diamond in those times in Cleopatra's uterus.
I did not know
and
that.
And camels as well. Used to have a stone in their uterus to
really?
Stop them from being pregnant on a long walk.
Thank you for sharing that. I've learned something very interesting.
So Nerida decides that a Marina sounds good and she comes in quite buoyed by a conversation she's had with her colleague. Mm-hmm. Because she's a bit older, mm-hmm. she might not need more than one. What's the story there?
Okay, good question. So I think, Beck, for her, I would like to encourage her to think that, you know, the Marina is actually ticking three boxes for you. One, it's going to hopefully get traction on some of this heavy bleeding. However, Beck, it's really important to clarify that she might have irregular cycles and that the volume is likely to reduce, but the Marina is not necessarily going to traction the hormonal highs and lows that will start becoming often worse in these few years leading up to the menopause. So realistic expectations is so important. And the second thing is obviously it provides very high-end contraception, being a long-acting contraceptive device. And the third thing, Beck, I would encourage her to consider would be that it could be a vehicle for hormone therapy for us if she chose to embark on that. If the tiredness did not improve and we felt that there was a component of this that was not just related to the fact that she was bleeding more. So I would say to her, yes, one Marina will last you 5 years. It actually depends on what your natural menopause, which always gets a bit muddied when you've got a Marina because
how do we figure that out for her?
So I hardly ever use biochemical management for menopause because as you well know, it's a clinical diagnosis when you've not had a period for 12 months. But this is one of the situations where I would. And again, I'd be guided by her. I'd be quite comfortable in a 46-year-old to leave it 5 years and then to address it in 5 years' time to see what's going on. But however, if completely, and you know what, at least one in five women are going to completely be amenorrheic after we put a Marina in, which then makes it hard to tell whether they're that because they're that person or whether they are now not having periods because they have actually become menopausal during this time. So I would play it by ear and let her know that, you know, we do cover women for contraception even after we think they're menopausal. So I think mathematically it's quite reasonable for her to have that for 5 years. And also emphasize that if you did feel that your symptoms, or let's say she had vasomotor symptoms or other symptoms, or was becoming now sleep deprived, or the other, you know, the long list of menopausal joys, then we could consider as one of the options giving her transdermal estrogen if she wanted.
So when I'm talking to her, because I've also started seeing her about some other things in her life, she's, you know, in that sandwich generation, mm-hmm. she's very worried about her mum and her three-year-old is having night terrors and so there's a lot more going on, but she's booked in to get the Mirena, and we're pretty happy that the heavy menstrual bleeding will probably improve. And currently she's using some tranexamic acid with good effect as well. So she's already feeling better. And her iron infusion made her feel $1 million. So we've sorted that out. But actually, it turns out that she's having really terrible hot flushes, and sometimes they're the thing that are affecting her sleep. Mm-hmm. And she's also arguing with her 20-something colleague in her office because they can't decide what temperature to have the air conditioning on, and her colleague has brought in a swag of cardigans and makes a point of shivering when she turns the air conditioning down. So she's actually she's really bothered by these flushes. So what are her options to treat that?
Okay, so like you rightly said, Beck, I think the initial traction when she gets the Mirena and in that space will, because these things are all intertwined, aren't they? The bleeding, the iron deficiency, which thankfully is now restored, the emotional and, you know, psychological and social issues that women are battling. Women are warriors. You know, they are juggling so many balls in the air, but the hot flushes then take you really backwards because obviously they contribute to the insomnia as well. And so what I would say is I would explore some basic things with her, because everyone should have a basic discussion regarding, you know, lifestyle changes in terms of, is she having a good diet, in terms of exercise, in terms of, is she, you know, clothing, which you've already mentioned that that's not very nice of the other person to do that, but to look at what sort of clothing would work better with her hot flushes, layering perhaps, those little fans are really cool. And so to empower herself with all the simple stuff. But we know, Beck, that in perimenopause, it's sort of almost 20-60-20 ratio. And we know that 1/5 of women scale through without any problems. They just say, my period stopped, and we're all jealous of that group. And then 1/5 of women have nasty symptoms. And then the 60% are in the middle where they're having mild to moderate symptoms. So I would then come back to her and say, look, here are some options, but we know that the most effective management of vasomotor symptoms and in general perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms is menopause hormone therapy. I do think, Beck, that this is a space where there's been a lot of mixed messaging and changed messaging. So even within our work life, we've had different messages that we've given at different times, and that hasn't done women any favors. And I think the risks of menopause hormone therapy are often not quantified in absolute terms. So they're quantified in relative terms. And if women hear something is double or something is triple, it really scares them. Whereas if they hear something, for example, breast cancer risk may be increased 2 in 1,000, and I would say, look, we have a 1 in 8 chance being women that we can get breast cancer. That is the most important risk factor. And if you layer that with obviously other risk factors, then that risk increases. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that sometimes menopause hormone therapy, the discussion needs to be very time-based and really unpacked with what are her philosophies. Does she want to consider hormones at all? If she does, can we look at the lowest amount that we can give her in the safest way? So transdermal estrogen, again, like I mentioned earlier about venous thromboembolism, this is the kindest from that perspective, so it doesn't increase her risk. Prometrium is the best from a breast cancer perspective. It has the lowest, they are body identical options. So I often will encourage her, especially because she's considering a Mirena, I would congratulate her for reaching out for a great first line option. But to say, hey, do you want to consider some transdermal estrogen? This could be a patch. And thank goodness, Beck, that we've maintained, you know, the patches on PBS over the advocacy from, you know, RANSCOG and Australian Menopause Society and the Endocrine Society, etc. But I'm also quite fond of the gel, because I think that it fits in quite well to women's routines. So when you use something on your face, on your, then just, you know, one squirt each on your arm could work quite well. So I would encourage her to consider that. I would obviously want to be, I'm often guided by the general practitioner input from a mental health point of view, because it can be very gray, Beck, in terms of where does, especially in women who have underlying known conditions, there's no reason why they can't worsen during perimenopause or menopause. And then it becomes hard to know whether, you know, just the boundaries of those pathologies, and often they're very intertwined, like I mentioned. So this would help on all of those fronts. But obviously, in certain cases, an Effexor could be considered, an SSRI could be a better option for her, or other alternates if estrogen is not.
And is that maybe a good option for people who have contraindications?
Exactly. So, or if she had more genitourinary type symptoms, which she's not demonstrating from what you've described as a primary issue, then we could look at more topical estrogen or topical vaginal moisturizers or lubricants, or work more in that space. But my experience, Beck, is that it's all quite connected. And once you start to unpack this, in fact, we joke, we didn't mention hysterectomy because this woman is actually quite suitable for simpler and less invasive options. But in women who do have significant pathology that would benefit from a hysterectomy, like, for example, massive fibroids or adenomyosis, etc., I find that, Beck, honestly, the women that we put on the table, on the operating table, is not the woman we take off. Because it's a new stranger with a very, you know, we're able to break that negative cycle for them. And even with an ablation, I'm finding that, you know, you really closing that tap replaces their losses, providing some thoughts on contraception so they're not fearing an unplanned pregnancy anymore, making sure they don't have underlying cancer, because in that journey, either whether with a hysteroscopy or with some women with a Pipal biopsy or others with obviously the whole hysterectomy, will get analyzed and we'll get the comfort of knowing that there's nothing nasty brewing. And then, of course, sorting out their perimenopausal side of things in terms of their symptoms. This combination and acknowledging that these are actual pathologies, I think, give women a huge sense of empowerment. And they are, in my experience, even the way that they sit in the waiting room when they're before and after, when they've had either their surgery or their Mirena, or even if it's tranexamic acid and Ponstan, just a solid plan organized, they're a different person.
Mm.
And I don't know, Beck, if women value midlife. This is one thing that I always say to them, that this is meant to be the best parts of our life. Our kids are grown up, or, for example, even though I recognize that, you know, we are the sandwich generation, but in some ways, I think many times a day, Beck, I do say, this is one of the best parts of your life. You need to value it. And all of these are things that we can help you with. Please reach out for the help.
Yep. And so menopause is, I think, as a GP and as a medical student or you know, someone that's outside of the O&G profession, can be quite confusing. Do you have any tips about good resources for people to go to?
Yes. So what we have done in our practice, Beck, is that there are certain videos on Australian Menopause Society, which I find quite helpful. I've put the links together we've created like a gynecology and an obstetric bank of information. And because in my practice, we have something called a patient portal. So every patient has a digital friendship with us, in which we then give this homework. And now we're trying to test if we can give it before the consult, or we're also, one of the projects we're involved in our practice is to create a video. So you're having some hot flashes, or so you'll have an abnormal CST or whatever. So that longer term is going to be something that we would like to share pre-consult with them. But in the interim, what we're doing is we've got the Ranscog menopause information pamphlet. We've got the Jean Hales one, because I think Jean Hales does amazing work in this space. And we have Australian Menopause Society fact sheets. So again, depending on, you know, whether she's the woman who just came to find information and doesn't really necessarily want to use any hormones, or whether she's the person who wants a particular, you know, wants to use Tibolone or anything that is the best fit for her, we give a general Jean Hales and a Ranscog information, so that again they know about their options, but then give specific information. And I've actually linked with all of the companies. So for example, whether it's Mirena or Estrogel or Prometrium, and gotten all their digital pamphlets, because we're very ethically and green. We try to be, not always, but we're trying to be as green as possible. So,
and are you happy to send all those links, and I'll put them into the podcast?
100%.
Because I think I think that's something. I went to the launch of the clinical standard that you referenced.
Oh, awesome.
And so they launched it at the RMA in Darwin.
I see.
For rural gent practitioners, because rural, it was an interesting conversation because we have a lot more people who go straight to hysterectomy in rural. And there was a little bit of what are the specialists doing there, but actually it's the human story behind that. You know, people just need to have a definitive solution and get back to their farms or get back to their lives. And so often it is actually patient driven. So that was an interesting philosophical discussion, but that's a really useful document, and I don't think it's probably got the airtime it deserves. So
it hasn't, it hasn't. So I think that this would be a great forum to highlight the value of that. And you're right, 6.6 times more higher hysterectomy rates in regional Australia in certain areas is quite disproportionate, isn't it?
And we have ablation up here in the northwest, thanks to our local specialists. So that's something that I do discuss a lot with patients. But we also, as I said, we had our nurse practitioner inserting marinas, and so I think our region does pretty well.
What an amazing option list!
That's so fantastic. I think this is a great way to kick off our clinical updates. And if we can share, if you can send me through those resources, we'll share them all. Happy. And I guess in closing, we would love to know what other updates people would be interested in, or if there's a medical mum or listening who's got a burning update in their area of expertise, they can get in touch and we can keep these rolling.
Fantastic.
Beck, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you, Beck, for the opportunity. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share on that topic?
What I wanted to just mention, Beck, is the model that I work in, that I set up, is a multidisciplinary care model. And I have found that medical mums are the most amazing people on the planet. So our anaesthetist is a medical mum, and that consistency, she's actually swapped into all of our lists. And I have Dr. Robin Sayer, who is a gynecologist, who is kindly connected with us. And it's so amazing to be able to have someone with such a high-end surgical practice scope to be able to connect and keep our patients local at Northern Beaches. And also, for example, we have a person with a urogynecology interest and a colorectal interest. So I just feel that it has been such a amazing journey to connect with a team of medical mums. And even outside that, to have the allied health, to have midwifery input, it really has opened my eyes to how much different, you know, and general specialist, GP specialists, how much each one of us bring to the table for the woman that we care for, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And I think in this part of life, I think, you know, our counselling and psychology colleagues are important sometimes as well when you're dealing with all of those life stresses.
100%.
But yes, I think that's one thing that women in general do well is collaboration. So
yes.
I guess that's where this podcast has kind of sprung up from, and these clinical updates, I think, will be well received, and hopefully we can keep each other up to date with all of our, you know, areas of expertise.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Beck. Take care.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about Ask a Medical Mum. And if you want some topics covered, get in touch and let us know. Or if you want to be on Ask a Medical Mum, please get in touch. Happy day.